Hi, I'm novelist and critic Kim Newman. I am joined by...
Writer and editor and, again, once more, unit publicist on Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, Stephen Jones.
And we just saw Clive Barker Presents, very obviously stuck in as a title card, for I understand his name was taken off and put back on.
When the film started, when I was first approached to work on Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, which I think Pete Atkins phoned me and said, do you want to come and work on Hellraiser 3? We'd like you to work on Hellraiser 3. I said, but you're filming that in America. And he said, yeah, that's fine. They'll fly you out. They'll put you up. I was like, okay, sure. Clive was attached as an executive producer because that was part of his deal with New World. And then at some point, and I think I've got this right, at some point, he got paid to take his name off it because they decided that he didn't want to really... link it with the other Hellraiser movies and all this other stuff going on and whatever. And yet when the film was finished and they watched it and they looked at it, they went, you know what this film needs? It needs Clive Barker's name on it again. And so they paid him again to put his name back on it. So he got paid twice on this movie for literally doing almost nothing except in LA. And I caught up with him and Anthony Hickox in LA some months later. And I'll tell that story a bit later on. Well, I'll tell you in a minute, actually. Clive was back on promoting the film. And I'm, as far as I recall, he never even came out to North Carolina.
Because we looked at the EPK, and it was full of like interviews with Clive saying...
That's all done in LA later.
You can see Anthony Hickox in the... And there's Christopher Figgs, co-producer.
Again, that's a contractual thing. I never talked to Chris at all on this film. Because basically Larry Mortoff
is the man
he's in it as well.
It's almost that he ended up owning Hellraiser for a while, didn't he, by being
and then moved to Krishna Locke and employ me again. So this was interesting. So I'm in LA a few months after we made the movie, and I find myself in a preview theater with Tony Hickox and Clive Barker watching a rough cut of this movie, and it opened with a very boring shot of New York. And I said to them, I said, you know what you need to do? You need to pan down from the sky onto that shot. And if you look, it's an optical pan. It's actually not part of the shot. And Clive was there also to suggest some things, and some of the stuff that Clive suggested also went into the film. And then sometime later, I was at Clive's house in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. And he showed me, he put a VHS tape on and showed me some of the stuff that was shot afterwards. So again, like Nightbreed, there were pickups and other things shot later on, which again, I wasn't involved with. But I guess let's go back to the beginning. So I got employed to come on this because I had done the first two Hellraisers. Pete Atkins had written the second one and had written this one. Bob Keane had done the effects. So except for Bob Keane and some of his crew, and me and Pete, and Doug, of course, as Pinhead, we were the sort of holdovers from Hellraiser. And this was filmed in North Carolina. Now, it was at a studio called High Point in North Carolina, which actually I think was an old Dino De Laurentiis studio where they filmed Cat's Eye.
Established the studio in North Carolina.
And the thing about that is North Carolina is a right-to-work state, so it's not unionized. So obviously, if you're working in a studio, you don't have all that stuff about demarcation and times and all of that. So in that respect,
tea breaks, safety regulations,
all that stuff,
overtime.
I know. Doug later complained he was working 17-hour days, and yeah, we all were. As I've talked about before, as a publicist, I have to deal with America and Britain and Europe, and I would go right the way through the night on set. And in fact, there was one night. That is Larry Mortoff, by the way. That is the producer of this movie, as the most coiffured tramp we've seen so far.
Is it supposed to be the same character?
Yes,
because he's bulked up a bit.
Yeah, and he's got a nice trim beard, Hollywood trim beard.
Well, I suppose everybody on this series got more successful.
He was married to Lindsay Wagner. Pretty cool. And at this point, he's working, you know, for Dimension and whatever. And then he later, when he became president of the Krishna Lock Company, and remembered me and employed me on two more movies. He was a very nice guy, and again, he was pretty much devoted to this movie. It wasn't one of those, and he also did, because again, what I didn't know until I arrived was they were shooting Children of the Corn. Which one was it? It was I can't remember now. Which one did he shoot that one?
It was The Urban Harvest.
Final Sacrifice, Final number Sacrifice. Two, because Anthony Hickox's brother was directing.
Yeah, James D. Hickox, who edited this.
Who edited this? Because you know, basically, it was the same crew, the same people in the same place. And when I finally arrived in North Carolina and went out, it was the last week of Children of the Corn 2. And as they didn't have a publicist on that, I ended up working on Children of the Corn 2 uncredited, doing all their publicity before we got into Hellraiser. So it was kind of interesting. And again, you know, we were out, we were staying in a motel, we were all put in a motel that they took over an entire motel and later an apartment complex. So we were all kind of living together and eating together and hanging out together. It was kind of funky. It was kind of nice. Mm-hmm. It was a nice feel to it on this film.
I know Pete met his wife.
Pete met Dana. Yeah, Dana was actually somebody who I knew better because she was actually the production coordinator on the second unit.
Yeah.
And I, to be fair, I took Pete and Dana out to a little Chinese restaurant, and Dana went to the loo, and Pete leaned over the table to me and he said, "I hope you haven't got any designs on Dana because I really like her." Yeah. I said, "No, she's just a friend. She's just fine. She's a friend." And they're, obviously, they're still friends.
You could have scotched his marriage just then.
I could be living in LA now in a lovely apartment and whatever.
And she's a really successful children's writer.
She's a hugely successful children's writer now. Yeah, she's done all. I mean, Dana's worked in all sorts of jobs over the years. Yeah. And she was a great
an
production
Academy
coordinator.
Award nominated producer soon after this.
Yeah, for a short, which Pete Atkins is in,
that's
actually.
Right. Yeah, directed by the late Stacey Title.
Yeah. Who I met through Pete and Dana, her and her husband. They're a very nice couple.
Yeah.
We went out to dinner one night. But yes, it shows you how it was all kind of working. But again, the great thing about shooting in a proper studio like we had at Pinewood was all the sets could be built. Mm. Everything was there. Everything was on site. But does it have the same feel as the other Hellraisers? That's the question I've always asked. And I think this is when it started to become American Hellraisers. I mean, even though Anthony Hickox, who of course is the son of the great Douglas Hickox, and also the Oscar-winning editor Anne V. Coates, he is British by birth, but he obviously has had a very successful career in America. And again, he's a great horror film fan, and he had already done Waxwork, and that had been
Sundown,
the Vampire in Retreat, and he'd used old actors in some of those films, and he knew what he was doing. And he brought a visual style to this, which is very different, I think, from Clive's and Tony Randall's. And, of course, I mean, the other nice holdover from this, of course, Tony Randall and Pete Atkins wrote the original story. Because at one point, both of those guys were going to direct.
Uh-huh.
Tony Randall was going to direct this again, and Pete Atkins was going to direct this again. And eventually it ended up that when New World went into bankruptcy, and a guy called Larry Cuppin, who was a studio head, shall we say, who basically ran, you know, he basically picked up in a fire sale some of the rights to Children of the Corn sequels, the Hellraiser sequels, that kind of stuff. And so that's how he basically got the rights to make these movies. And of course, since then, they've moved on down the line, and we'll talk about later on probably about the sequels and the different companies over the years.
This is the point where it becomes a franchise, right?
Absolutely.
Everything's an installment.
Although this did get a theatrical release. Yeah. And look at this nurse. I'm going to tell you a bit about that nurse later on. This is where he got a theatrical release, and I think the fourth one got a restricted theatrical release. And then after that, they're all director videos, after that stuff. But yeah, and so you know, the one thing I think I'll say about Anthony Hickox is there's a man who knows what he's doing. He arrived fully prepared. He had every shot worked out, so he never did any covering stuff he didn't need. And of course, his brother is co-editing this, you know, and they worked very well together. I mean, Christopher, I think it's Cibelli, if I pronounce his name, was Cibelli, had already worked on Waxworks 1 and 2 and Sundown, and then went on to work on Warlock, the Armageddon.
And actually, I believe that one of the strengths of Waxwork is that Hickox asked Bob Keane and Image Animation Board and said, "Have you ever just wanted to make Dracula and Frankenstein Monster and a werewolf in the Phantom of the Opera, because I got a script which will allow you to do that." And basically, every makeup guy in the business secretly wants to do a werewolf and the Frankenstein Monster at some point.
And they do great ones as well, and there's a Nosferatu and all sorts of things in there. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing was that Bob was already on this film, Pete was already on this film. I was a late addition to this. But again, you know, basically working with Larry Mortoff, and he was great, and he was a really good producer. There were various other producers on this, obviously, as well. And basically, you know, it was a different kind of crew, very much American, because we were the intruders in this one in many ways. A few of the special effects people were the same, which I thought was quite good actually. That worked out quite nicely. But yeah, at the end of the day, it is what it is, which is basically an Americanized version. But because Pete wrote it, he obviously knew the previous two, so elements of those previous two are taken over. But I think the one big difference here is that suddenly we've seen Doug Bradley's name now above the title, which is the first time that's happened. And Doug's Pinhead, I think, loses a little something by being taken out of the shadows.
I think the same was true of Robert Englund's Freddy Krueger. He became more and more the above the title star. He got more to do, but he was less scary.
Yeah, I mean, and he's got the quips in this. It's Pete Atkins playing Rick the Barman. That is actually, that's not his accent, unfortunately. He's dubbed because he has a very thick Liverpool accent.
Yeah, it is, in fact, Anthony Hickox's voice. You say, is that symbolic of how the relationship between director and writer is in Hollywood?
Well, he ruined his performance. But again, I mean, I think Pete carries it off very well. And of course, later on, he's turned into a Cenobite, which means that he can live for the rest of his life signing photos at movie fairs and reunions and things like this. I do think, however, and I think you might agree with me on this, any film, Kim, that has music and dancing in it is automatically dated. I think of that Satanic Rites of Dracula and all those things.
It does kind of date things in a way, but it's one of those things, you know why they do it. And I think probably it was about the time of Dracula AD 1972. Maybe there's a little bit of it in things like Curse of the Crimson Altar. And there's like
Scream Again. It's definitely got.
That's right. And there's rock and roll in I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Yeah.
But it's not like Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi have to stop for a couple of minutes to get some Glenn Miller tracks.
Except of course,
In that K. Kaiser movie.
Yeah,
that's right. The look on Bela Lugosi's face when K. Kaiser is playing suggests that perhaps he wasn't that keen on that form.
But the problem is, and we've talked about how these films date, and in many ways, I think this of the first three films has dated the worst because. I think the 80s are back again now.
Yeah, it is in fact a 1992 movie.
Exactly.
But like a lot of 1992 films, it's really easy to say it's 280s, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just, fashion was in transition at this point. Music was in transition at this point. And it's always dangerous to do that. And I know... I know Anthony Hickox was very much down with the music scene in those days and things like that.
Oddly enough, his other films use... slightly classic music. I mean, I know, for instance, Waxworks ends with It's My Party by Leslie Gore.
Yeah.
And Sundown ends with Town Without Pity by Gene Pitney. And both of those are brilliant music choices that somehow sum up the film you've just watched and are fun. And what's more, they're songs you can remember all these years later. I couldn't hum any of the music.
Well, the music on this one's by Randy Miller, which is almost incidental.
Hickox again playing.
Shooting some guns.
I think he goes. Yeah.
He's going to get killed in a minute. He's going to get shot to death. Yeah. But basically the music in here is by Randy Miller. But of course, the music you remember in this is the clips of music by Christopher Young from the first two movies. We've now got to know is the Hellraiser theme. Yeah, there's Tony getting killed. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting. And again, you know, these were fields.
But I know Alice Cooper came and did some tracks for Friday the 13th and Elm Street movies. And it became, I think there was a sort of feeling, and I actually talked to Pete about this, because Pete is a big music guy. He was in a band. He's saying it's a mistake to think that just because heavy metal has a lot of satanic imagery and all these guys are into horror films, that their music goes well in horror films. And he said he would rather have had slightly weirder music choices. For instance, I know he uses a bit of, like everybody our age, I think he was really impressed by the way Dennis Potter uses music in Pennies from Heaven and Singing Detective. I think that's what Pete would really have liked. And he does a bit of that. You have a bit of vintage old-timey radio
music. As we also
talked
about on the first film, you know, Clive had his own idea for the music, and that was overturned. That was, an independent band and whatever.
And oddly, the thing is, I bet Coyle's music wouldn't have dated.
Exactly.
Because it is... Yeah, because, I mean, Steve Thrower, our good friend, is the musical... Well, the genius is behind Coyle. Because... He has always been weird. Right? It's like he's always...
So it just stays... But I think that's also the good thing about the end music on this, because it's by Motorhead, of course. And it just sounds like a Motorhead track. I mean, Motorhead, you know, if you're into that kind of music, it's never dated. And in fact, you know, there's a great music video, which I don't know if it's on this set or not, with Clive and Doug Bradley as Pinhead playing cards with Lemmy. Which was done at the time. So, I mean, that's the kind of music I'm saying that doesn't date. But, I mean, that band, I can't remember what their names are, the band who are in that club scene, I mean, have you ever heard of them again? Probably not. Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those things.
I think officially the first horror film to have, like, a contemporary music in it, weirdly, is Dead of Night.
Oh, really?
Where the Hullaluba is the song that's in the Ventriloquist episode. And that's an attempt to because it's a show business story, to root it. It's actually a very Hellraiser-y kind of sequence as well. So,
For 1945, yeah.
Yes.
Wow. So here's our two main actresses, I guess. Let's talk about those. Yeah. So one is Terry Farrell, the former model. There she is. And also, obviously, was much better known a little bit later for being on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, playing Jadzia Dax, I think, until she got killed off in it. And she's done a few other bits and pieces, but she mostly retired from acting in the early 2000s. And I think she's very striking in this. I think she's got very striking. But Paula Marshall, the other woman in this, who's quite younger, she was in Tony Hickox's Warlock, the Armageddon and Full Eclipse. She was lovely to work with. I really like Paula, and she was although this is early in her career, she was a true professional. But also she liked to hang out in the evenings, and we'd play pool and have drinks and stuff, a whole bunch of us, and I think she gives actually a very good performance in this, and because it's a nuanced performance. She goes from being this victim to this strong woman, and then back to victim again, and pays for it in quite a sad way.
It's this particular role. It's what I always think of in horror, in the women's roles. You've got Mina and Lucy.
Yeah, Mina and Lucy. They all goes back to Bram Stoker.
Right.
Yeah,
and particularly in franchise horror, you have quite a lot of Lucy type characters. I remember the secondary women in Nightmare on Elm Street 3. And Scream, Rose McGowan, and that they have that, but they can't, hold the film together the way the Mina character does. But they steal all their scenes.
They steal the scenes, And I say, I think she's really good in this. And watching it again, not too long ago, I thought, oh, actually, that's a really good performance. And I said the really nice thing was that she was just so pleasant. And I also think, this Pillar of Souls, which, is the whole film we've watched, I think is supposed to be the pillar we saw coming out of the mattress at the end of the previous Hellraiser.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's better made and it's better designed now. And I'm not a great fan of going back and changing films like George Lucas did with the Star Wars movies, but I wouldn't mind them going back and just changing that optical and putting that Pillar of Souls coming out, in Hellbound. Yeah. And in fact, there's a scene later on when the Pillar of Souls explodes and Pinhead comes out. And I just picked up some of the debris of that and had it sent home. So I actually have a piece of the Pillar of Souls in my house now.
Now, of course, every Hellraiser fan in the world is working out where you live.
Well, that's it. Well, as you know, I've got the box from the previous film and I've got a bit of the Pillar of Souls from this film. I should have got a hook from Hellraiser. or a pin, even.
Yeah.
A pin from Doug Bradley's head.
How do you feel about Kevin Bernhard, who's de facto the male lead of this
film? He is, and he's a deeply, deeply unpleasant character.
Yeah.
To be honest, I didn't really get to know him very well on the set. And the reason is because it's such a difficult role for him, this. And he is so unpleasant and so deeply unpleasant in this film that he was actually more method. So he had to psych himself up to before filming began, which he did.
He's just come off 114 episodes of General Hospital.
But he... You know, you can tell he's bulked up. He's, you know, he's a fit looking guy. And he would go away into a corner of the set and get himself in the mindset before the cameras rolled. And then he would come on, do this role, and then literally just leave the set again because it was so exhausting for him.
Yeah. He later became a writer and a producer.
Yeah, and he's still working today.
He wrote Jill Rips, that Dolph Lundgren Jack the Ripper film, and Turbulence 2.
Oh, no, he's still working today, and I think that's great.
3,000 Miles to Graceland.
I've got to say, he was, again, I have no complaints about him. You know, he was a lovely guy to talk to and work with and whatever. But for him, I think more so than anybody else in the cast, I know it's a weird thing to say, he probably had the hardest work to do on this film. Because he has to be up all the time as this character. I love this because you know what this is, Kim. This is Dracula, Prince of Darkness, right?
I was at an event, an academic weekend thing with Doug Bradley once, and they showed this and Dracula, Prince of Darkness on the same day.
Ah.
And Doug came out at the end of it and said, it's the same story. It's Pete stole it, didn't he?
No, Pete didn't steal it. But you know, it's a little touch of Hammer homage. And I love that. And you know, if you're gonna bring Pinhead back, why not? Yes, but you know, and of course, it's always about the blood. Whether it's the blood on the floorboards, it's the blood on the mattress. Now it's the blood because again, the mattress is gone. Even they weren't going to move the mattress around.
I'm sure you would have had to carry the original mattress.
Well, they've got Oliver to come in and bring it.
He was probably too expensive by then.
By that point,
I think he'd started his Ideal Husband type career. So
it's the Pillar of Souls is the way they bring him back. But of course, you know, you saw Pinhead's face in the Pillar of Souls at the end of number two, and again the genius of Pete Atkins' script was he took that and he turned it into something else, pretty much the same way Jimmy Sangster took, you know, bits from the Dracula films or the Frankenstein films, flipped them to get into the next movie and did it like that.
And I think there's actually quite a lot of parallel with the Hellraiser series and the Hammer Frankensteins and Draculas. They have the same thing of sort of having a continuing story and then just giving up and then saying, now we'll just reboot it and hope you forgot what you saw.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And here we've got some scripts that aren't really Hellraiser scripts, but we'll put the box and Bradley in and that'll
turn we all know, and you'd think you would learn that the best Dracula films had Christopher Lee in and the best Frankenstein films had Peter Cushing in it. And it seems to me nobody ever learns from this.
And there are a couple which have the equivalent of Ralph Bates as Pinhead.
Well, you know, I mean, from my point of view, I always think of these films as Hellraiser is Frankenstein, Hellbound is Bride of Frankenstein, and Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth is Son of Frankenstein. In that order, in that quality control, and if you want to go ahead to the last one that Pete did, which was Hellraiser Bloodline, I think of that as Ghost of Frankenstein.
Or maybe more Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, because that was also a film that was hacked around.
For a different reason. But then once you're after that, you're into the Abbott Costellos, as far as I'm concerned, and the House of Draculas and all those kind of things. I think there is still quality control at this stage. I mean, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. I've said this so many times. I mean, I read reviews by people who never understand how movies are made, and you see comments online now. You know, people criticize things for ridiculous reasons because to make a movie takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And nobody sets out to make it. Well, I mean, I think there are directors.
I think there are two. I can name.
But certainly, everybody when you're working.
I can
working
think of whole
it,
companies. Yeah. Just me.
Troma being one example.
Yeah. I was thinking, actually, I think the Asylum probably.
The Asylum.
I'm
sure some of the people who work for the Asylum, I think they are making a good movie. Obviously everybody has the highest hopes for their movie. Yeah. Everybody does the best they can. The cinematography on this is by a guy called Jerry Lively, who actually is a director as well as a cinematographer, and who has worked with Tony again. And Jerry, I'm not sure if he was English or whatever, but he was a, I think was a really good, I mean, I miss Robin Vigin on this one, but it is an entirely different looking Hellraiser, this one. It is more contemporary. It is more American. It doesn't mess around. I mean, this is definitely set in New York, this one. You see that from the skyline and the Twin Towers and all that kind of stuff in there. And on this one, of course, Bob Keane sort of oversaw the special effects, but was the second unit director. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff we did out in the fields, which were around High Point in North Carolina, and which, of course, we've been, you know, in cornfields for Children of the Corn. We were now in fields for Hellraiser, which was unusual, to be honest.
Yeah, Jerry Lively later directed Darkness Falls, which is a creepy little ghost story.
It's a great little
And also movie. One of the Dungeons & Dragons sequels that you don't remember.
Oh, right. Yeah, but, but yeah, it's the Twin Towers, you know, whatever. Yeah.
And I have to say, at least this isn't Canada pretending to be New York, is it? Yeah,
no, it's North Carolina pretending to be
New York. North Carolina pretending to be New York. I suppose it doesn't have a kind of Pinhead takes Manhattan line to make you realise that, hey, why aren't there scenes in Times Square?
Well, except there is an ending to this, which basically does set it up for something along those lines. Yeah. And in fact, it did come up later on.
And I think if you were making it, if that was your USP, was Hellraiser in New York, wouldn't you have the Statue of Liberty with pins?
Maybe, as
your last image.
This was a real club in Greensboro, in North Carolina, in the nearest city. Most of these people are just extras from the local community. One of the things I had to do was go around the local restaurants and stores, hand out flyers saying to people, hey, do you want to be in a movie with Pinhead? And, of course, by that point, everybody knew. He was like the Freddy Krueger, in the 80s. And so all these kids knew exactly who this was. And they could turn up, and they had to wear, like, their most outrageous club gear. I remember that was something on the little flyer I designed with a picture of Pinhead. And it was like, wear your most... Because, again, there was no costuming for this. So they had to wear their leathers and jackets and whatever, and their outrageous dresses. And basically, they just hung out for a couple of days as extras in a Hellraiser movie. And, you know, I think they got paid a nominal amount of money and got some food and whatever while they were doing that. More thrusting in a Hellraiser movie.
Right,
this is quite explicit.
It's thrusting and smoking at the same time. I
mentioned smoking on number two, but they said on the first commentary, there's a lot of smoking in Hellraiser movies. Now, the interesting thing is, Pete Atkins explained to me that basically, Anthony Hickox didn't agree with smoking bans in America. And he smoked, Pete Atkins smoked, Doug Bradley smoked back in... They all smoked back in these days.
They've all given up now.
They've probably all given up now. I know, certainly Pete Atkins has. But yeah, so basically, everybody smokes in this movie. Even Terry Farrell, who's given up, takes a cigarette later on. This is actually a Canadian actress called Amy Lee, who was, again, very pleasant, only came in for a few days for this role. No other credits. Right? She's done some voice work on games and things like that. But I tell you what is interesting, again, like with Paula Marshall, is watching this back now, I actually like a performance more now in this film than I did at the time. There is a little bit of an element there of three-dimensional to what could just be a two-dimensional role. And she hasn't got a big role in this. You know, we're not going to see her for much longer. But, yeah, I thought, you know, actually, she gives good performance in this. With Kevin, I mean, he has to behave horrible to her. And I think he generally found it hard to do that, which is why, you know, he was doing the method thing. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I got no problem with that. You know, all actors and actresses have to find their own way into a role and out of a role. I think with Paula here, I think she did it through the costuming. I think her costuming is very interesting in this. Whereas Terry Farrell is just wearing, you know, day clothes for a reporter. Paula here is actually wearing a little bit more designery type stuff. Again, strong women. I mean, if you're going to say one thing about the Hellraiser series, strong women roles all the way through. And I think that's certainly was a theme. I think that sort of petered out. I think you'll agree, Kim. It was some of the later sequels because they just became, you know, hack up some teenagers and that kind of thing. But even number four has got a strong woman evil character.
There is a point where I think there are a couple of sequels which were made to retain the rights.
Yeah. Retain the name. Yeah.
And so they would have, basically the script for a Prophecy movie and rewrite it to be a Hellraiser movie or whatever. I mean, and Prophecy was another
an old franchise
that was going at the same time. And there are, Was it Stephen King realised even he hadn't seen all the Children of the Corn films?
Yeah. Well, they were turning them out once a year at this stage. I mean, again, you know, they. I think these guys did that second one.
At the same time as Witchcraft, The Howling. The
Howling particularly.
Child's Play. There are various... It's like... And I remember at the time, horror fans were starting to say things like there are too many franchise films. And it's like... If your ambition is to make Child's Play 2 rather than Child's Play, that obviously is a lessening of sight.
Except a lot of these films are calling cards. Yeah. And they were made as calling cards to move on to other things. And you've got to remember, of course, and you and I remember this better than most people, early 80s, early 90s, it was the video boom. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could make your money back just on video
and
sales.
I remember talking to various people who were working on these franchises. And I know in particular it was true of the Elm Street series. It's like... You make an Elm Street sequel, the next thing you get is a Die Hard sequel, and then they'll give you an original.
Give you an original film,
That was the that Stephen Hopkins and various other directors went through, isn't it? It's like, you do a good job on a little horror franchise movie.
Yeah, you work your way out.
And then maybe you'll get a remake, like Chuck Russell.
I've got to say, I love the fact that we have a skinless Sandy in this. Yeah. Just a nice little touch.
Yeah.
To throw it back again. And these first three, and in fact four films, have these little touches in them, which I think is like, okay, it's a little homage to, you know, the previous film and the imagery in that. And again, I mean, I loved it. There's actually a photo of me in this box exactly where Doug is now, not with the pins in my head, I have to say. Because, you know, we all took turns. We all got in there and had our photo taken.
Yeah. And so you were saying that... Doug was appalled at the long hours he was expected to
work. We all
Does that
were.
Include being stuck in this thing?
It's not great, to be honest with you, because obviously...
It's never pleasant.
Well, again, if you think about it, I mean, it was basically a hole cut in a rubber box.
Yeah,
so
it's
the box
like those seaside...
Like a seaside, exactly.
Man,
exactly.
Where you put your head
but
through.
But once he's got his head in there, they still had to retouch up the makeup and do that. So, you know, but I think what I love, film, I love these scenes of Doug in the box. Because it's really where he becomes the stage actor again. He's almost like, you know, he's and the dialogue is so rich in these early scenes that Pete wrote for him. Again, it is a little Freddy, you know, it's a little bit of that kind of thing. But because Doug's voice, he carries it off really well.
I mean, we were saying that this was one of the things about this particular film is it's where Pinhead becomes a bit too much like Freddy. I'd forgotten how much actual... And it's not even Clive Barker dialogue, it's Pete Atkins
dialogue, isn't it?
It's that particular high-flown, weird, sort of perverse style. It's only later on. In fact, it's things like Spitting Out the Bullets is very Freddy Krueger, is very franchise.
And, of course, once you get to the club later on, he starts making wisecracks
and things like that. May well have been a mistake.
I got to say, you've got to think about Fifth Avenue Entertainment and Transatlantic Entertainment, Dimension Films, Miramax, of course, back in the early days. These are the guys who wanted it to go in this direction.
Yeah, they wanted a franchise.
Yes, they wanted a franchise. Yeah. And they wanted a franchise that went to a specific target market. Mm. So you are now starting to see younger actors. I mean, other than Ashley Lawrence's character in the previous films, we're starting to cast younger now in this. It's not an adult. I mean, I know Terry Farrell is probably older than most of these people in this. Well, she's probably not that much older.
She's like 27.
Yeah, exactly. An old person.
Yeah, old lady.
Middle-aged. But yeah, you're starting to see a slightly younger demographic in this. And I think that's one of the reasons that Tony Hickox was the director, is because he understood that. He understood it from Waxwork and Waxwork 2, even Sundown, The Vampire in Retreat. It's got people like David Carradine in it, is pretty much aimed at a younger audience. And once you've got these images, because, I mean, as I said, you know, the lighting, the camera work, this is bright, this is sharp, this is sparkly. Whereas the other films were kind of grunge, like Alien, you know? The early Aliens were all grunge down. The early Star Wars were all grunge down. This film isn't really grunge down unless you know, it's meant to be grunge down because it's like a loft apartment or whatever. I like these scenes early on because you get the sense it's basically he's selling his soul. It's basically what's going on here. And he's being seduced by the Prince of Hell. It's a really nice few minutes on the film before it turns into a bloodbath. But yeah, I mean, you know, you can see Doug's enjoying himself as well, because finally he is out of the shadows. He is finally allowed a bit of free rein. And I think, if anything, this is when he makes the character his own. And I've got to say, I know I'm personally biased, but he was and is the best Pinhead. I don't think any of the others have come close. I mean, even in the 2020 reboot, whatever you want to call it. It's just,
you know, do you think that Doug enjoyed essentially becoming a movie star on this film?
Yes, I think he did. I mean, we all had good times. I mean, and I think, like any actor, you want to be recognised and then your performance respected. And so, yeah, why not? Now, this is interesting. So this footage that she's going to be looking at in a minute, which is where we bring back Ashley Lawrence as Kirsty Cotton, I cut all this together. It was actually, I didn't film it. It was filmed back in Los Angeles. I mean, Ashley never came out on set, although I did meet her afterwards. So they filmed all this in LA, and they had all the Rush's material. And so they, because I was the video guy and I was doing the EPK, they sent me off to cut all this together and degrade it. I mean, it wasn't degrade. I had to put all the degrading on it, make it out of focus, put the dropout on it, put all the breaks in it with a hash and stuff like that. And basically create these scenes which they could then replay back. Like, I put all this in, the break material, and also with the later stuff you see with Captain Elliot. And that was a kind of fun thing to do, except it was the day of the crew photo. So I'm actually not in the cast and crew photo for this film, because I was in Greensboro editing all this stuff together for a day. But it's kind of interesting, and it was another little thing I could do. And I say, I love the idea that Kirsty's still in it, and I love this as the follow through. I love that, you know, it's the Chanard Institute. So, you know, they kept that piece of information running through as well, that little piece. More smoking, obviously. but yeah, and you know, we had to do optical zooms on this stuff. And then this is also I had to do as well, the double image and all of this kind of stuff, just to create those effects. And I didn't make up these effects. You know, it was all in the script. It was all in, you know, here's a shot list, Steve, go away and do it. And in fact, I had to go away and do it on exactly that kind of material or that kind of equipment. And the rewind, you see, again, all the rewind stuff had to be pre-recorded rewind, because she couldn't do it live, as it were, there. So yeah, it was another little thing I did. I mean, like the roach wrangler on the previous movie. I was like the video guy on this one, but yeah.
So you had more creative input on this film than Clive Barker.
I know, because actually in the end, Clive came back in as executive producer and made suggestions and changes were made and extra bits were put in and whatever. So no, I wouldn't dare say that. And I think in many ways, this is still part of Clive's vision. It may not be exactly his vision, this one.
Clive, rather like John Carpenter on Halloween and Wes Craven on Nightmare on Elm Street, could never quite leave it alone.
No.
It's like they understood that this was their work and it was great work. Yeah. They also had a sense that they wanted to get away from it sometimes. But it's like The Godfather. They kept being pulled back in.
But I thought also, once you've created something which becomes iconic, and I do truly believe the Hellraiser movies at least were iconic. I'm not sure they may be quite so much now. Yeah, why would you let it go? It's your baby. It's your creation. And you're seeing these other people mess around with it in your world. You might want to come back and have a little creative control. And I say, what was very nice is in LA afterwards, when Tony and Clive and I were all watching it, Tony was very open. He was rough cut. He said, "Yeah, you guys just tell me what, you know, if there's anything you think we can make better or was too long or too short." And you know, it wasn't like Tony was not going to talk to Clive about it, because he respected what Clive had already done on Hellraiser and what, you know, the people had done on Hellbound, and he genuinely wanted to make this a proper Hellraiser movie.
It strikes me he was more interested in actually making a Hellraiser film than making an Anthony Hickox film. Because certainly his earlier films had been Anthony Hickox films. And maybe,
and some of his later films are as well.
Yeah, the film he did with our friend R.C. Matheson, Full Eclipse.
Full Eclipse, which is a TV werewolf movie.
Yeah, werewolf superhero cop movie.
Cop movie, yeah.
That was his idea. That was, something he generated.
And it's a shiny, sparkly, action-packed movie.
But he did a Warlock sequel as well. Which
the Armageddon,
again,
yeah.
is fitting into somebody else's
Which actually isn't. Ashley Lawrence in that. Yes, she is. Yeah. I mean, I thought Ash, every film Ashley made, she grew as an actress, and then she became a very good artist in later years as well. And I think it's a shame, because I think she is a good actress now, and you know, I think she gives good performances. I mean, even that little cameo there, and she gets special billing. And again, because I did the credits on this one, I gave her that special billing. That wasn't in the script. It wasn't anywhere else. But I said, no. You know, if it had been and Vincent Price as, you know, the gravedigger, want that extra credit. And so I wrote that extra credit. And they just went with it and put it on the titles. you know, so I finally got, you know, I think that, because that's what we look for, right? You know, those sort of like, and also starrings or whatever. Credits are important to actors. And also because, you know, she was a follow-through character, which there aren't many in this.
Yeah. Thanks to the Scream series, we now have terminology for this. It's legacy character.
Legacy character. That's a good way of putting it.
You can bring back a legacy character, but you can also kill off a legacy character.
Yeah, indeed.
As a move.
And again, we know we've talked about Ashley coming back for Hellraiser Hellseeker number 6 in 2002. So somebody had the same idea. Yeah. And in fact, I did a Hellraiser outline with Michael Marshall Smith, the novelist and screenwriter, which we actually took to Miramax, Hellraiser 5 Hellfire in 1998, which would have been Hellraiser 5, obviously. It would have been a millennial Hellraiser, because, you know, we were worried about what was going to happen with the millennium and whatever. And the whole thing was designed around Kirsty Cotton coming back to London. It was set in London, not America. And the concept was that London was actually a physical lament configuration box, and it was, and you could join up the Hawksmoor churches across London and create the lament configuration, so that when the millennium came and the world came to an end, it would be the Cenobites who did it. And we went through several meetings. We had meetings in London, we had meetings in Los Angeles, and then Miramax just went off and did something else, basically.
Yeah, it's the Scott Derrickson one, was it? Inferno.
Is that a Miramax one as well?
I'm not sure.
You see, I'm not sure. I think they just dropped the idea.
That was the fifth Hellraiser, wasn't it? Yeah.
And that became the fifth one, yeah.
Which actually I think isn't a bad film. I think it's
a real director and a real writer.
Yeah. And I think Craig Sheffer is good in it, which is an...
And of course, Craig Sheffer is in Nightbreed.
Yeah. But it is... It has a conventional morality, which isn't quite what the earlier films.
Well, I think as they move further and further away from not only Clive's vision,
but Pete's
and
vision.
And Pete's vision as well. Yeah. I agree. And you know, and I think that's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what you like about the Hellraiser movies. I don't think there's ever been. I'm trying to think. Has it ever been a really, really terrible sequel? I can't think of one that's so terrible. No,
there have been worse examples in other franchises.
Yeah.
Other franchises have gone lower. It's like we can toss up. I think it's that Howling sequel, which is about line dancing.
God, yeah.
That, I think, is the worst of any of the franchise runs. That said, there'll be people out there who've got other nominees for that particular title.
But again, Howling's a good example where it there jumped from one... Again, I think it was New World originally. Yeah. Then it jumped to another company, and jumped to another company, and jumped to another company. And then ended up... Harry Allen Towers was making them in Romania or somewhere, wasn't he?
Or Czechoslovakia or something. Where every Howling film was made on a different continent.
Yeah.
One in South Africa, one in Australia, one in Hungary.
Marsupials. That's is that the South African one?
That's the Australian one.
The Australian one.
It's the original Nightmare. I have to apologise for people listening. We're getting into the heavy minutiae of franchise filmmaking, and let's not even talk about the Witchcraft series.
Yeah, which is up to 10.
More. I think it may well be like 15 or 16.
I remember watching the first few on video back in the day, but
For a film you've never heard of, managed to get 14 sequels.
That's the video
boom. The video boom was
VHS.
Like there are...
Unbelievable.
I don't know, 4 Mirror Mirror films or Silent Night, Deadly Night films. Horror films came in bunches, and it's like almost accidentally you could find you had a franchise.
And you didn't know it's the audience and who made it a franchise.
Actually, the other one I know is up there in numbers is Puppet Master.
Yeah, and they're still making those, aren't they?
Yes,
they've started remaking
Master
them again.
Puppet Master might actually win out in the end if Charles Band just keeps at it. I think it might have to get the Guinness Book of Longest Franchise.
Although, to be honest, what I love about those films is he crosses over characters from different films as well. Yes, so you probably have a Trancers Puppet Master crossover or something. And again, this was interesting because although it was filmed in North Carolina, these were they had to dig real trenches and then get extras in dressed in military uniform and all this. So this was quite a major scene for a reasonably low budget movie.
But it was America, so you assume everybody knew how to shoot a gun, right?
They probably their own guns. They probably brought their own guns to the shoot.
Yeah.
And I noticed actually when rewatching this that some of those costumes don't fit quite as well as they should.
I also noticed that there's a severed arm that turns up.
I think that's where Bob Keane just hold that in and doing the second.
It's Bob's pet severed arm.
It's another one of my video inserts going in, being played in at the moment. But Pete had remembered what he couldn't put into Hellraiser 2 because the dollar had crashed and we couldn't afford it and whatever. So some of that material then comes back into this version now. And we learn a bit more. We now name our captain as Elliot, Captain Elliot.
Elliot Spencer. Two poets.
And basically, and that's Pete again, obviously, doing his reference.
Yeah.
And Doug gets to play basically himself.
Yes.
As an actor, you've got to relish that. And I think, towards the end where both versions of Doug are on screen, although obviously we use a body double and I'll point all that out, I think it's actually quite cool. It's quite a cool conceit and quite brave for what is, as you say, a franchise movie.
Yeah. Thinking about it, I know it's still an active franchise, but the way things have been going lately, isn't probably the next one to do the World War One epic, which ends with Spencer's death?
Yeah, that'd be a prequel or something.
You do these villain origin stories now. You can do young idealistic Captain Spencer becoming disenchanted and decadent during the war.
But here you go. Look, here's another line. Come to Daddy. Again, it's been come to Daddy, come to Mommy, come to Daddy. It was as you say the flow through.
Yeah.
Which is now lost, unfortunately. I don't know if they ever... I can't remember if they ever use that line in any of the sequels.
It's the next one which kind of breaks it, doesn't it?
The next one was absolutely... Well, actually, the next one, number four, is Clive's idea to set it in different time periods. Mm. So I guess they could have jumped back and done a Spencer and that, but they decided to go back to France in the 17th century or whenever it is instead. So, but, I mean, I again... And you would appreciate this more than I do as a novelist, is there are so many ideas in these early Hellraiser films that are never actually expanded upon or whatever.
And the smart thing is not to expand on them.
Yeah, you don't have to expand on everything.
The tendency now is to fill in everything.
Yeah.
And to remove any element of ambiguity from the story. And I think sometimes what's great is the throwaway line that implies whole continents of stuff that have happened, and then you never pick it up again,
and you never just, find out where
you just move on. I remember actually talking to Pete even before the major hassles on Bloodline, and sort of saying, so why isn't it called Hellraiser: Hell Something? And Pete said, yeah, they just didn't get that. But they'd had branding on the first three that they, obviously Hell on Wheels or
later on they do Hellseeker, don't they?
Yeah, that's right.
And we'd called our perspective one Hellfire because we kind of got
that. Hellworld later.
Yeah,
you think there were enough varieties of that not to go with Bloodlines, which is frankly bland.
Yes, it is bland.
And quite a lot of the other, it's that. Hellraiser: Something, and I don't think there's one called Hellraiser Evolution, but most franchises had
Evolution. Or was it was the one where they go back to the beginning again? Was it the final chapter? That's the one.
Chapter.
I always remember when you and I used to go and see the final chapter all the time, and then there'd be another one next year.
Yeah, and I remember
a new chapter.
I remember our good friend Nigel Floyd saying about Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. They should have called it Friday the 13th, We Lied.
We lied on the last one. And again, I thought this scene was quite good because it actually reflects Andy in the first one betraying Claire, and then Claire betraying the next characters. So this idea of betrayal as well, where basically you think JP is the villain, But now he's going to become the victim.
Yeah.
And then she's going to kind of, you know, take over. Yeah. And I thought that was quite interesting as well. That, you know, you can't trust anybody in a in these early Hellraiser films because they don't conform to the stereotypes. And I thought, wow, okay, yeah, that's good. The same way they killed off the heroes in the hero in the last one, now they're basically killing off the villain.
Yeah.
Halfway through the movie again. And those are the little surprises I kind of like, you know, and putting the bolts through his head and, you know, that kind of thing. It's kind of cool. It's kind of interesting stuff. And this is where I think the box blows up and my piece is one of those corner pieces at home. And those are like little stick puppets they had on the side that you could work. But it's just some nice stuff in there. I mean, it's of course cool. It's more gloop. They love gloop.
Yeah, that was a very 80s, 90s effects thing. Wasn't it? Slime,
lots of slime.
Yeah, it had gone beyond blood into slime. Blood wasn't enough. You had to have slime.
Or slimy blood, which they have quite a lot, as you see here. Like, a lot of slimy blood. That's a bit I've got. That's my bit at home, that corner. It's still in my office at home. And again, you know, this is Dracula has risen from the grave, as it were.
I believe there's one tiny shot there where you see what you assume to be Julia's face.
Oh, maybe. Okay, yeah.
It's skinless Julia who was on the...
There's
a little shot there of an immobile dead face. I think that's the last we see of her.
Well, I mean, I was talking to Pete about this not very long ago, and you know, to be frank, the reason that Claire Higgins isn't in this one is that she didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And they were very much prepared to follow Julia through into this, at least into this third movie. But she said, no, I've done two. She's not really a horror film person anyway. Yeah. And she decided, I think she wanted to go back to the National Theatre or the Shakespeare.
To be fair, she won two Olivia Awards.
She won Olivia Awards, yeah. She's like, a very, very good stage actress.
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, do you want to have slime poured over you
North Carolina?
This
is not to say that she ever dissed the Hellraiser films. And she's never denied being in them or turned her back on them. Yeah. But I think, you know, this was shot in America. It wasn't shot in London. It was a very different thing. And she said, no, I'm not going to do it. And so that also involves some hasty rewrites on this. Because, you know, now they'd lost their lead character and their lead villain. And in many ways, that might be why it bumped up Doug's billing to above the credit. Because they said, well, OK, now we've got to do something.
That presumably isn't the same radio that we saw in Hellbound.
It's supposed to be.
But it looks a bit
like it's supposed to be the same radio. But of course, that one was at Pinewood. Yeah. And that was, of course, several years before. Yes. You remember, this is actually quite a big jump now because we've actually jumped.
I will point out that the BBC didn't start broadcasting until at least 10 years after
but
World War
The lovely
I.
thing is it's not plugged in. Kim, yeah, so that's it's right. magic. Yeah. It's a magic radio. Yeah. That's the lovely thing. I think it's supposed to be like that's supposed to be the same Pillar of Souls we saw in Hellbound.
I think this is a shot from Hellbound.
Maybe they cut something in on this one. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that we don't get the recap at the beginning of this one that we got, which I thought was quite interesting. Because by this point, if you didn't know what Hellraiser was, you wouldn't be going to see this movie anyway. I guess because of the whole implosion of New World Pictures, it has been a few years in between. And I say I'd already gone off and done other movies in America. I'd actually already done stuff.
This was a Dimension film, and Dimension was
another company like New World.
Yeah, but it was the genre shingle of Miramax.
Yes, right.
Was it? And so did you have any dealings with the notorious Weinstein brothers?
I certainly didn't, and I don't even know if they came down on set. Like, because I know the guys from Morgan Creek came down on Nightbreed.
Yeah.
Whew, that was an interesting story. But on this one, I certainly never had any dealings with them.
I know Guillermo del Toro said he made a film for the Weinstein brothers, and his father was kidnapped by Mexican gangsters, and that wasn't as bad.
I know, certainly on Hellraiser 4, there was some problems with certainly Bob Weinstein. Mm-hmm. Weirdly enough, the other one, supposedly the better one, the nicer one.
Yeah. Fair to Bob Weinstein, he wrote The Burning. He was a horror fan.
Yeah, he was a horror fan, but he also was a businessman. They both were businessmen.
Yeah.
And so, were they interested in the creativeness or were they interested in the making the money?
Yeah, I think that...
It has to work as a film.
Bob Weinstein, and after all, he back-screamed and all these other...
Yeah.
And the whole idea of Dimension as a genre label was something that he was genuinely committed
to. And it worked for a few years there, yeah, absolutely.
But he was famously difficult to work with.
I think that's what eventually derailed the Hellraiser franchise with number four, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a minute. And this is quite cool, because this was where they basically had to recreate that set from Hellbound, thousands of miles away in North Carolina. And they did it. I thought they did a very good job, actually. That is actually a dummy of Doug as well. It's not Doug just sitting very still. They actually created a dummy because they needed a dummy for the later scenes where the two of them appear in the shots together. Lot of night shooting on this movie, and it was cold. It was cold, the night shooting. So again, we'd have done a full day in the studios in North Carolina. Then we'd have dinner, and then we'd be driven out to the night shoot, where we'd shoot for another 5 hours. And I can remember one day, Pete Atkins and I finally got back to our apartment block where we were all living at that point. And I think it was like 6 o'clock in the morning. We had literally been up nearly 24 hours by that point. And he and I looked at each other and we said, yeah, is it worth going to bed? Because we've got another call. You know, we've got to be on set again in about 3 or 4 hours. And so luckily, the lovely producer I worked with, who was a woman called Olive McQueen, who was a wonderful, wonderful lady, who kind of looked after us on this film. And she had had several cases of beer delivered to our rooms, you know, literally tins of beer. So we sat up for 3 hours, drank beer, watched a bit of TV. And as we walked over to the studios, I said, the sun was coming up in North Carolina. And I said to Pete, isn't this beautiful? Look, the sun's coming up and here we are and we've had beer and it's all lovely. And he looked at me and he said, who the hell are you and what have you done with Steve Jones? But it was that kind of camaraderie on these films. And I kind of miss that to a certain extent, that, you know, everybody mucked in. But, you know, Doug was right, because, you know, during the day he'd be playing Pinhead and they'd get him out the makeup, give him something to eat and whatever. Then they put him in this costume and they drive him out, and then he's got to act at night in a field somewhere in the cold. So they were long days. But what they did try to do was then maybe he would have 2 days off and then they'd be shooting something else and then they'd bring him back again. So it wasn't like they worked these people to death. They were very careful about how they worked people. But yeah, they were long days, of course, which would never have happened in a British studio. You wouldn't be able to do that, or it would cost a lot in overtime. And again, I don't think overtime is a thing. I don't know if it's still true now. But because it's a right to work state, you could basically do what you wanted.
Was there ever any possibility of shooting this in Britain?
That's a good question. No, because by the time those 3-4 years had elapsed, I think, you know, that bus had gone. Clive, by this point, I think, had already moved to America. I think Pete was about to move to America. Doug Bradley, of course, didn't move to America until more recently. So there was a sense that basically, yeah, all that stuff where I thought, oh, we're the new Hammer films. This is what we're going to be doing. We're just doing Hellraiser. We're doing Nightbreed. And, you know, because remember, we'd already done Nightbreed by here, this as well. I mean, that had come and gone. So, yeah, I think those days had gone, and now it was basically an American franchise, and that's how it's going
to
continue.
I think this has no British input at all on the business side.
No, I mean obviously, was Chris it Entertainment? Fig- I think Entertainment did release it here
yes,
again,
yeah,
didn't they?
And
yeah,
Chris Figg is still credited.
And Chris Figg is still credited, but I say that's a contractual credit as far as I know.
I'm not sure how deep into the series that contractual credit lasts. I think he...
Possibly the next film or not. I mean, it might be just this one as well. Because remember, he was removed from Nightbreed under, I think, I still think, very bad circumstances. Yeah. But it just goes to show you how American film companies are much more ruthless than British film companies. And it's all about the money and the work and all this kind of stuff. But I say, we were very lucky because we had Lawrence Mortoff, who, as I say, liked me enough to rehire me on a couple of Christian Locke movies later on. And we had the wonderful Olive McQueen, you know, who basically was like our mother. I mean, she was a lovely middle-aged lady, and she looked after us and made sure she made sure we did eat properly, and yeah, so they had it was a case of beer waiting for us.
Oh, here's the ending of
the ending, and you know, there we're seeing it again. Yeah. But I guess it's morphed, it's changed. Yeah. So here, it's like a sort of like. It's showing us how it's morphed into this version now. So, I mean, the explanation is there. It's a bit, you know, befuddled and whatever. And of course, the chains are back. We've got to have the Clive Barker chains again.
That's right. It's almost, that's what makes a Hellraiser film is now, is the dangling chains.
Dangling chains. Well, hooks and chains. That was always the thing, as I said. And, you know, I like these scenes, again, because I think there's a sense, I mean, you know, as you know, Pete likes history and he knows his stuff. And so I think there was very much a sense that, yeah, you know, this could have been the Vietnam War is the other flashback, of course, which is an American war. But this is a British war. This is the First World War. He's a British soldier. And those are Tommies being killed there, you know, with the British hats on and whatever. So there was a sense to try, again, it's kind of that British-American thing, which after, well, I guess this fourth film has it to a certain extent with the French bit, and then it just becomes an American franchise after that.
Although, of course, a couple of them are shot in Romania.
Of course, Romania can stand in for anything.
I think the last one was Bulgaria, but
weirdly enough, the two films I did for Krishna Lok for Larry later, one was shot in Romania, one was shot in Hungary, or Bulgaria. I think maybe it's Bulgaria actually, because I think they're right to work countries where you don't have to worry too much about stuff.
I think that the lesson of franchise horror is, you cannot make a film in the Texas Chainsaw franchise not in Texas.
I think that might be a rule. That might be written into the contract.
Certainly, you cannot make a chainsaw film in Bulgaria.
Now, I'm not sure. The band here is Armored Saint. I don't really know much about them or if they ever went on to anything.
I'll say it's not my field of expertise.
No, I find it interesting. It's Motorhead at the end, but the band playing in the club is Armored Saint.
Well, I suppose you could say that Motorhead wouldn't be playing.
There's Pete Atkins again in his cameo. And some of these little hanging things. This is Image Animation, obviously, because it's all, you know, radio controlled little props. And, you know, there's a little touch of Beauty and the Beast here as well, and whatever, with the hands coming through the walls. This one quite nice. And, of course, that reflects Julia crushing Frank's heart in the previous film. And then we get into this absolute mayhem. And this took days to shoot, or at least a couple of days to shoot. There's stuntmen.
There's a woman there who's wearing a top, which is in the style of Piet Mondrian, the artist. And actually, the hero of Hellraiser wears the same shirt.
There you go. Yes, so there's a good tie-in. And this is where I think the moment where Pinhead becomes Freddy.
Yeah.
I think, you're all my children now. But this is interesting. Watch the guy who's about to be impaled on a pool stick. There. Yeah. That's Zach Galligan. Now, apparently, he was a friend of Tony Hickox's, and of course, had been the star of the two Waxworks movies before. I don't remember Zach Galligan ever coming down to High Point, so I presume that was one of those insert shots they did later. But when I told you, Tony and Clive and I all went out and we saw the rushes and we had a little meeting, we went out to dinner after that in a nice restaurant in Beverly Hills, and Zach joined us for coffee. I thought, well, why is that Galahad sitting down? Interestingly, he knew Tony and Tony had invited him for coffee. But the reason he was there was he wanted to meet Clive. He was a huge Clive Barker fan. And of course, Clive knew him from Gremlins and all that stuff. And he was absolutely charming and pleasant. But I never knew he was in the film as an uncredited extra. That's his one little scene. But I think that was shot as an insert later on. Because I think I told you, when I went over to Clive's, he had a VHS of all these extra scenes I'd never seen. The same way on Nightbreed, at his house, he showed me the stuff with John Agar, which again was all shot in Canada way after we finished Nightbreed. So, yeah, I mean, and it's just one of those things you do on a film. You look at it, you think, oh, that needs another beat, like we did with the Birth of Frank in Hellraiser. But yeah, that's Zach Galligan there, so there you go. And of course, he turned up again in Warlock the Armageddon. For Tony Hickox.
And it's odd, for somebody who was like the star of the Gremlins film.
And he's very good in those as well.
He's not worked hugely since. I mean, he's still working, he still turns up in bits and pieces. And also, he's got that feeling of, as you say, someone who's a fan, who picks projects or whatever.
Well, basically, I tell you, over coffee, Tony and I just talked to each other because he focused on Clive and just chatted to Clive for the whole evening. And it was like, okay, fair enough, that's fine. So this guy, the cowboy-looking guy, is a guy called Ken Carpenter, who basically, plays mountain men type characters. But he was in The Phantom of the Paradise, you know, and he was in Elves. I don't know if you ever really remember that.
Yeah, I saw Elves.
Elves. And of course, Tammy and the T-Rex, which is not.
Which weirdly is now a popular cult type movie. I saw it on video when it came out and haven't really revisited it.
I think I saw it on VHS and have never watched it again since that time. Because again, it's a very early 90s movie, that movie. But again, lovely guy to work with. And a real physical presence. I mean, he was over 6 feet tall. And the way he looks in this film is the way he was. Mm. I mean, he was like a cowboy. And I thought he gave a good performance. He was a nice guy to hang around with and play around with, and whatever. I did mention actually that Kevin Bernhardt's girlfriend at this point, and I thought this was quite interesting, was the actress and singer Apollonia.
Oh yeah,
you know, who was best known for co-starring opposite Prince in Purple Rain. Well, she was married to Kevin Bernhardt at this time, so she came out for a week to the studio. So when I said, you know, we were all playing pool and drinking beer in the evenings, there was Apollonia playing pool with the rest of us, and she was. I'm surprised they didn't give her a cameo in this film, because she was so nice and so easygoing, and talked to everybody. She's one of those people who really again hasn't had a huge career, I don't think. And I'm surprised she didn't get like a little cameo in this, because she was with us for a week. Maybe they asked her and she just said, "Nah, I can't be bothered. I just want to play pool with the rest of you, you know, and drink beer." That was an interesting thing as well. Greenboro was the closest town, I guess, major town to us. We basically shot all this stuff in Greenboro. And eventually, as you'll see, as we're coming up to the last third of the film, we closed down. They let us close down streets and blow things up and set fire to things. And there were police, there were firemen around and whatever. But I guess they're used to it. I guess they were used to it on all those Dino De Laurentiis movies, Cat's Eye and all that kind of stuff. So I guess they were...
Because there was a feeling around the time that North Carolina was going to be a big movie hub.
It was supposed to be. It was supposed to be.
I don't know if that studio is even still in the business.
I don't know. And it's probably gone through several different hands.
But there
then.
Was a period when a lot of films...
Well, what was good about it was, like Pinewood, everything was on one piece of land. So the cutting rooms were there, the makeup studios were there, the sound... The problem with the soundstage was it was really only one giant big soundstage. So if you were shooting on several sets, they all had to be built at the same time in the same soundstage. So one of the things we did find a little bit difficult was maybe Bob Keane is shooting some insert material on one set, which means you couldn't shoot the actors until he had finished on another set in the same place. So when we got out and did some of these location things, it was kind of a nice break because it allowed the people to do the second unit stuff. I've also got to mention, and this is something Pete Atkins and I really kind of enjoyed, was there was a guy who worked on this movie who was from this area. All right. And he was a guy called Phil Smoot. And he was basically the production coordinator. So his job was to make sure that, you know, the cars were there, the actors were there and everything else. And he had a long history because he lived in North Carolina. So he had a long history of working out there. And we got to know him because he was a guy we saw every day. Until he mentioned to us that he had actually directed a couple of direct-to-video films in the mid-80s. And we said, "Oh, really, Phil? We had no idea." He said, "Yeah, it's a film you've probably never heard of. It's called Alien Outlaw and the Dark Power." Mm-hmm. And we went, "No, I never heard of those films." So they were regional films. They
only came with Lash LaRue.
Both with Lash LaRue, the old cowboy star.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah, well, I've seen them now. And in fact, to be fair, Phil brought the VHSs over. We watched them together on one evening. But yeah, and he had worked with his really aged, I think he was probably in his 80s at the time, Lash LaRue. Yeah. And they're actually not terrible regional films. They're quite fun. He was our unit production manager on this movie. And again, he knew everybody and he knew, you know, who to go to if you needed such and such a thing.
I mean, frankly, it's a shame you couldn't have got Lash LaRue in this.
Do you know what? He was still alive at the time.
Because he would have fit perfectly into the Hellraiser universe.
Well, yeah, as I said, Clive got John Agar to do a cameo on Nightbreed.
He was famous for his use of the whip.
He was?
Yeah.
He was. He could have done a chain. He could have done with a chain.
They haven't yet reached the point of doing the Hellraiser franchise entry, which is a Western. Which, All the others have done it. You know, there's a Tremors, which is a Western, and a Ginger Snap.
There's even a Back to the Future, which is a Western.
That's right. So yeah, they could do, you know, Hellraiser, Dodge City.
I mean, I think there was an attempt with the fourth one to try and put it into different milieus, as it were. And I actually think the outer space one works quite well. I mean, and of course Friday the 13th ended up doing one in space as well, which I thought was quite good.
And there's a leprechaun in space.
There's a leprechaun in space as well.
Although actually, I think Leprechaun in the Hood is the best of those.
It's
sequels.
A better film. Yeah. I agree.
Leprechaun's another franchise of the era. For a franchise sequel that sounds like a stupid idea, Leprechaun in the Hood turns out to be quite smart.
It is a funny film as well. It's a good film.
Yeah.
But again, that's an example where I think they eventually replaced the star of those films with a different actor, and it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same. Now, I think bringing Pinhead into the real world like this is slightly a mistake now, that he has become this almost this Freddy character, and he's playing with her and whatever. I know, you know, for Doug, it's a fabulous opportunity to give it his all and whatever, I don't know if it's a good idea or not. And in fact, some of the sequels, they do kind of knock him back a bit more. Yeah, you know, he's a bit more of a mysterious figure.
Weirdly, in some of the sequels, and I think probably because they either don't have Doug for very long, or they're just trying to, they've tipped Pinhead into somebody else's script. Some of the sequels have almost no Pinhead in, even though he's on the cover.
Yeah.
And actually, I think the less you see of him, the more impressive.
It's the whole Night of the Demon, isn't it? Or Curse of the Demon. Yeah. Basically, the less you see of something, the more effective it is. Yeah. Val Luton knew that in the 40s. Yeah.
The most effective Hammer Dracula film is the one he's only in for 8 minutes, isn't it? It's the more Christopher Lee stands around saying, my revenge is complete
and pointing
at
things,
the less scary he is. But when he's just there, and actually I think that Christopher Lee actually sort of didn't quite understand that Dracula was a great role the fewer sides he had. If he just stood there, he was like immensely impressive.
Yeah, he was.
But from an actor's point of view, he looks at the number of pages he's got to see and the dialogue he's got to say.
I think it's the same with any actor.
And I think he doesn't quite get just how impactful that is on screen.
And I thought that was true of the previous two Hellraisers, that when Doug appears in the attic and the light comes through the slatted windows and whatever, and then he steps from the shadows and the light picks up the nails in his head and everything, I think that's much more dramatic than seeing him wandering around in a club full of dead people and having pages of dialogue and whatever.
He's sort of doing the Terminator, isn't he? Yeah.
Well, of course, this is the other thing that starts with this film is, they didn't have the other, supposedly because the other Cenobites are dead. They were actually killed, and Doug Bradley's character Pinhead comes back. But so they started creating new Cenobites, and I think a lot of these films, you know, the next one has another bunch of Cenobites, and in the comics, because other writers got involved, started inventing their own Cenobites, and it just became this thing where, how can we make it even more outlandish? Yeah. Oh, we'll have them joined up this time, or we'll have them.
And I have to say, after none of the Cenobites from any of the films from 3 through to 11, I think,
whoever up to now,
match the original.
I agree.
And they try, and you know, points for ingenuity for camera head here. It's not a bad
because he was
idea.
A cameraman. Now he's got a camera head. And if you notice, now this guy, this is one of the special effects guys. I was offered that role and turned it down. And in fact, he was in another scene which has now been cut from this film. Where he was a drug dealer, and he's in a cafeteria and he's dealing drugs, and so they actually offered me that scene, and I stupidly turned down. I should have done the cameo, because I could be signing stills and making $40 an autograph now. Yeah. It's just one of those things.
You'd probably get more money doing that than you got paid for this job.
Oh, probably. Yeah. I don't know. It's just one of those things. But yeah, that was one of my mistakes, I've got to say. But you know, you just don't know. And I was like, oh no, I don't do that. I'm behind the camera, my friend. I'm doing that. That was Steve Painter, who's one of the special effects guys.
Do we now have to explain what a CD is?
I do, because CD head. What was that guy's name? Was that Brent Bolthouse, wasn't it, or something? Brent Bolthouse, which is one of the best names in the world, to be honest. he was in Waxwork 2, Lost in Time, and Warlock the Armageddon, and Full Eclipse. And he's now a music producer, weirdly enough. So maybe he was like a music, always a music guy.
He sounds to me like mate of Anthony Hickox.
I mean, yeah. And here's Peter Atkins, who has now been turned into a Cenobite. And that is Pete under that makeup, right. Right, in that fat suit. Yeah.
And did he...
He didn't breathe fire, that's a model.
That he was, did he insist that he actually be allowed to be a Cenobite?
No, it's one of the things that, again, I think was offered to him. And he went, sure, that sounds great fun. And I like the fact they give him the cocktail shaker, although I don't think it's ever a Molotov cocktail that he throws. Or maybe it is when the cars blow up. But the fact is that, and I thought that was quite clever in the script, that each of these people have been turned into the worst version of themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, for this, we closed down Greensboro for a few nights, and we really did all this. Fires were set, local news crews came in and filmed it. And as you've seen, Kim, some of this I filmed for the making of video afterwards. But yeah, nowadays, of course, I don't know whether he would be Blu-ray head, wouldn't he?
Even that. I'm sorry.
Streaming head.
Yeah, that's right. I think digital download head is not really going to cut it, is it?
Oh, yes, he does throw a Molotov cocktail. I'd forgotten that, yeah. We blew up these cars. And again, that's a model head sideways and whatever. So but this is pretty impressive, to be honest with you. That's a real street, and these are real controlled explosions.
But this is the point where it actually becomes an action movie rather than a horror film.
And as you know, Tony Hickox loves action in his movies. He's an action director.
It's like he'll make a film set in a waxwork and have a car chase.
Absolutely. That's what Tony does. And this, I think some of this was shot separately later on. This guy who plays the priest in this was actually, weirdly enough, he was the local casting director who, again, got a role in the film. And he's a guy who was called Clayton Hill. Doesn't really mean much. But they both came from Pittsburgh. So of course, who did they know? They knew George Romero. So they're in Dawn of the Dead, and actually they're in Night of the Living Dead as zombies. And his wife,
not everybody in Pittsburgh was.
Well, exactly. But his wife, who played the nurse at the very beginning, who we saw killed up against the wall, Sharon, she also worked as a casting person on this film. And then I think Sharon Hill, and unfortunately poor old Clayton died in 2009, although Sharon's still around doing stuff. And some of this material was again reshot in Los Angeles later. When I went to Clive's house, he showed me some of this on a cassette. And again, Steve Hardy, who was the set designer, who also worked on Nightbreed and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and things like that, he had to, you know, create this church set and exploding stained glass windows and all this kind of stuff. So a lot of this did have to be very closely controlled. There's some nonsense I've seen online where people say, oh, the people of North Carolina were up in arms because this was, you know, defiling the church and it's a church state and everything else. I talked to Pete about this not recently. We don't remember any picket lines or people complaining or whatever. Maybe it's a story somebody put out, you know, as a press story. There was
no
sense.
Would have been your job to put that story out.
If anyone was going to put that story out, it would have been me. You wouldn't want to do it. We weren't allowed to film in the church, and so the scene where she's going up the steps, we kind of shot that at night when nobody was around. That is a real church. But then once you cut to the interior, it's all Steve Hardy's set design. And of course, if you are Christian, then this is kind of blasphemous, to be honest with you, because it is basically an inverted crucifixion scene. And he even, not only takes the pose, but he basically has the lines or a variation on the lines. I can see how that could be offensive to some people who are, you know, who have religious beliefs. And that's, you know, but again, you know, it's like all these Hellraiser films, they are, you know, pushing the limits at this point, still are.
I also think that pushing the limits, I think Doug is pushing the limits of this performance in this sequence.
And I think a lot of this is post-production, so we're not
post-main
shoot.
I think this is where he is being asked to go over the top.
A little bit too much. Yeah. A little bit too much
in
your face.
Weirdly, he's less scary when he goes.
And I think that's the interesting thing about the next one, Bloodline, is Pete pulled Doug's performance in that film back.
Yeah.
And so basically what happened was that the Cenobites go back to being almost secondary characters in the film. And it got trade show, it got previewed, and all the fans, when they filled out the little cards at the end, went, "Where the hell's Pinhead? Why do you have to wait this long for Pinhead?" And the Weinsteins went Natsoid, apparently, and they said, "No, no, no, we're gonna have to change this, and Pinhead's gonna have to come in earlier into the film, and everything else." And Pete Atkins and Kevin Yeager, who directed it, the special effects guy, said, "Well, wait a minute, you read the script and approved the script. It's always been like this." But again, because of commercial pressure from the fans and the viewers, they took the film away from Kevin Yeager and Pete, to be honest with you. Pete and Kevin Yeager basically said, "Okay, we're not getting involved in this. This is not what we signed up for." And they brought in, what's that guy's name?
Joe Chappelle.
Joe Chappelle, thank you. Yeah. Who did a lot of stuff with Dimension coming in doing reshoots
and things. He did a
Halloween
thing.
And so he shot extra material. They cut material out. They rearranged material. Mm-hmm. And so technically, Hellraiser Bloodline, as it got released, is not the film it should be. It's not the film that Clive wanted. It's not the film that Pete wanted. It's not the film that Kevin Yeager wanted. And he took his name off it and put an Alan Smithy credit on, which of course was the great... who was the first person to use Alan Smithy?
I think it was Don Siegel.
It was Don Siegel, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, for Death of a Gunfighter. But it was, I think there are suggestions it had been used on television before. It was the Directors Guild of America.
It was a
had
default.
A pseudonym.
Yeah.
They say apparently you couldn't release a film without a director credit. So if the director took that error, or occasionally, I think the case of Don Siegel and Robert Totten, they didn't actually take their names off it, but they weren't allowed a co-directing credit.
Oh, so they said
because,
that, yeah.
And I think it was a case that one director left through illness rather than being fired. So it was like, Alan, and they put this credit, it lasted for about 15 years, and then everybody knew what Alan Smithy meant. It was like an in-joke that got out. And they retired Alan Smithy.
Right.
And I believe Thomas Lee replaced Alan Smithy for a while.
He's a new guy in town.
But I don't know if they still do that. But I've always felt that there was a series of film books called things like Lynch on Lynch and Almodovar on Almodovar. They should do Smithy on Smithy, because everybody who used an Alan Smithy credit has
a great story to tell. They did it, yeah.
I once interviewed Pete about Alan Smithy for an encyclopedia entry, and he gave me a great quote about what it was like working with Alan Smithy. And it says the particular auteur style of Alan Smithy, and he's right. All Alan Smithy films have a kind of feel that...
I discovered an original cut of Hellraiser 4 up in my attic this morning before
right.
I came over here to do this.
Yeah.
And hopefully that might, you might get to see that on a box set at some point or on a Blu-ray.
Providing Bob Weinstein doesn't find out where you live.
True, but it's actually it's the Kevin Yeager cut with his name still on it. And I think it's great that we've still got that knocking around, which is, I think terrific. And I think that's really when it all started to fall apart, to be honest with you, with the next one. The Ghost of Hellraiser, as it were.
Yes, yeah. And
as you can see, now we've got CGI effects coming in for the first time. Great CGI effects, because it's very early
on. And I
would
say, weirdly, I feel the same about the Elm Street series. And even maybe Child's Play, there's something about the fact that it was physical effects that is actually really inherent in the stuff. It's like Ray Harryhausen does 3D animated effects. Toho put sumo wrestlers in suits on miniature buildings. That's just the style. Whenever you see somebody trying to do one of these films using another form of effects, somehow it just doesn't work for me. I so much feel that these 80s based franchises, the Hellraisers, the Elm Streets, even the Friday the 13th, they require that sort of tactile, John Carpenter called it rubber on the floor and the ketchup bottle effect.
I mean, I think there's something to be said. I know Ray would use a stick with a ping pong ball on, didn't he?
Yes.
Give the eye lines and then put the monster in over the top. But if you're actually reacting to something that's gloopy and standing in front of you, you're going to get much more of a performance out of somebody.
Yeah.
And it's going to look more real. I guess that's not true anymore. I guess you can make anything look like anything.
Except
now,
there is still a kind of weightlessness
to,
particularly the CGI horror effects, CGI gore and monster. It just doesn't quite register. I don't find it scary or disturbing, whereas with even sort of some of the sillier Charles Band Puppet Master type movies with little creepy puppets,
and they are they still puppets work. Again, yeah, they're still, they still like little stick puppets and things.
And actually, Charles Band, although probably the cheapest of the franchise guys outside of Troma, he was committed to stop motion animation.
Did everything,
yeah,
for everything in those films. And you know what? Good scripts on some of those films as well. I mean, you know, it comes down to the writing, it comes down to the concepts. Now, this I do think is a mistake. I think seeing Pinhead in daylight, it just doesn't work for me.
And actually, that was a weird
presto changeover. It was an optical,
optical too, that didn't quite work.
But yeah, I just think, you know, blue skies, do we really want to see Pinhead in sunshine? I know it's a dream sequence or whatever, but I would like to have seen it go, you know, suddenly go to night again. When you transformed into Pinhead, it should have gone from day to night. So we had that sort of good evil thing again. It just didn't work for me. Although, again, you know, it makes for some interesting stills. We've got some very interesting photographs out of this.
I also think that having Pinhead just stand there and talk to people.
As you know, that's what Freddy does. That's what they all do at that point.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a speech and bore you to death.
That's right. Yeah. it was the other guy who was Chatterer, you know.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. They should use Chatterer. Nick Finch would have been very pleased.
Yes, yeah. He could have done with the trip to North Carolina.
North Carolina, we all did, yeah.
Did you get any sense that some of the people who were left behind by this production had a sense of regret that they missed out on the next?
I mean, just being with their
friends again.
There must have been a sense of regret.
But you
here you have Doug coming from the shadows, and I like that. I think that's great. Harry comes out of the shadows, and basically this was done with doubles. So basically, obviously, Doug played one role as a double, and then they reverse the camera and they shot it around again, and then put it all together. And I think it actually, when you watch this, you are kind of convinced. Oh wait, there are two of them. That's kind of cool. It's very neatly done, and again, you know, Tony Hickox knew exactly what he was doing here. I'm not sure Terry Farrell was quite happy with this kind of bondage bit at the back there.
That's a split diopter shot, which is a fairly classy.
It's classy stuff. Very classy stuff.
Brian De Palma loves those. It requires a huge face in the foreground and something equally in focus in the background. You see it in quite a lot of Italian 70s movies. Italian cinematographers like the effect too.
It was actually used. There is a striking shot like that in Hellbound where is it Hellbound or Hellraiser? Where they go into a room and I think it's Claire Higgins' face is in the foreground.
Yeah.
But of course, what it is the background figure is out of focus. Here, of course, they're both in focus,
that's
as you say.
What you
that's the whole point.
For.
And it's Brian
De
Palma
does
shot.
It brilliantly often.
And I think this is a clever ending. I think, you know, this is again Pete Atkins pushing the franchise to another level, where you have, you know, the two halves of Pinhead facing off against each other, and of course there can only be one outcome. At the end of the day.
We know that there are not going to be another 7 Elliot Spencer, slightly disillusioned World War One veteran movies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Basically, I think his arc is going to end around now. Yeah. But at least he had an arc. At least the character has an arc. At least it follows on from Hellbound. So it's still part of the franchise. And I still think that's good. And again, a lot of this is... Well, some of this was makeup. So when you see them joined... That's optical, obviously.
Yeah.
But a little bit, that's makeup.
Yeah.
So that, you know, poor Doug had to wear sort of like, and that's makeup as well. So it was a combination of optical effects and makeup to create this sequence where, you know, he gets sucked in again. I think it works okay, actually, for a film, you know, made in the early 90s. It kind of works all right. And that's probably a bladder. That's probably your air in a bladder doing that. And it is a shame, as you said earlier, Kim, that, you know, companies like Image Animation, I don't think they really exist anymore. Hmm. People like Roy Ashton don't really exist. He worked for Hammer and did the makeups.
I mean, I can say, because I worked with Dan Martin, 13 Finger Effects, and Dave Elsey as well.
Dave Elsey's still doing that kind of stuff,
They've both got their little crews, and they do actual gloopy physical effects.
Yeah.
But it's almost not like artisanal now, isn't it?
It's like stop motion, as we were saying earlier.
People like the effect, and I know Dan has relationships with Brandon Cronenberg and Ben Wheatley and various other filmmakers who just like that kind of effects and will keep using him. And he's got a very distinctive
style. I also like here that she puts the box into the Leviathan shape, which again is a throwback to the previous film. You know, and we don't really ever find out, as I said last time, about what Leviathan is. But at least there's another nice little reference to a pointy Leviathan box.
It means that Pinhead is killed by a stake through the heart.
Yeah, like Dracula. Yeah. This is obviously Pete Atkins' Dracula movie, as it were.
Has Pete dusted off that spec script he wrote for Hammer when he was 13, you know?
And I always like the fact that all of that was happening somewhere else. You know, yeah, she's still back in the construction thing. And I thought this was a terrific ending. And I know Clive loved this ending and really wanted this concept to go forward at one point. And it does to a certain extent. It gets picked up a couple of times.
It's referred to a little bit in Bloodlines, but it's really hard to...
Yeah. But the idea, it would almost become a science fiction movie in the next one, if you'd followed through the logical course of what happens. But I gotta say, even at the time, I think that might, all that was optical, so it was all put in after I finished on this movie. But I look at this last shot and go, holy crap, that's pretty cool, actually. That's pretty cool. And it's the natural progression of the Hellraiser things. In fact, in many ways they took a step back and did something else with it, which is one of those great things you can do. But that I think is, from this moment onwards, you think, there's something going on here. And of course, that's on the box. That's a design that's actually on the box. And then, this is an optical coming up. And I think it's pretty smart. I love that. I think, holy, where are we going to go? And I love the idea that that little desk is the cube and everything else. And it's almost organic, So there we are. So I think overall, we would say pretty good, all three of them.
Yeah, no, it is.
No stinkers
point,
there.
It's the point where the series settles, doesn't it?
Yes.
It becomes a repeatable formula from now on. And you can have variations on it, but it's almost like you take the surprises out. But it is, the expected pleasures of franchises, isn't it? You know what you're going to get every time, but you've got to have enough variations.
And I think these three films together, it's for all Smith's credit, these three films together do that. They basically, if you take them as a trilogy, and I do, I really do think of these as a trilogy, and if they ever put Hellraiser 4 back to what it should be, I think you could include that as well. I think they stand very well. I'm very proud to have been involved. This was it the last time I heard from anybody. They never called me again. I'm not even sure they have publicists on Hellraisers anymore.
I think there was a choice between bringing you back and bringing Pinhead back time. And
I guess he worked cheaper than I did. So this was my last one. I don't mind that. I was privileged to be on all three of these films. And... I don't really talk about it much. In fact, this is the first
time.
That's
your actual proper
credit. I actually get my, because I did the credits this time, Kim, so I spelt my name properly. Mm. And Keith Payne was a local photographer. But overall, I think it's been fun. Thank you for your involvement in this, because it's been fun chatting to you about it. Because over the years, we've talked about these things on and off. But nice to put it on the record.
Yeah, that's right. It's to get actually all these stories together. And I think...
Well, there are stories I can't tell you, because Pete Atkins told me I wasn't allowed to tell you.
Do you want to tell you what? No need to mention names. Just put one of the really disturbing stories in now. one of the really indiscreet ones.
I'll tell you after the copyright line, right?
Yeah.
In a minute. I'll tell you the story I'm not allowed to tell you, but it's going to be coming up in a minute. But it's been fun to go back as well. And one of the great things I had was going back through all my files and because I kept everything on these. I kept all my notes. I kept everything I had. And going back and reliving this from, got to be, 30 odd years ago now, all these films? It's a long time ago for a lot of us. Yeah. And it was of its time in a certain sense. And I've moved on. We've all moved on in some ways. They were good, they were fun, and I gotta say it's been a pleasure and an honor to go over these, and I've worked with some really nice people. There's other films I worked on which weren't so nice, but on the three Hellraiser movies, I'm not gonna have any real complaints there at all. And I, and to be honest with you, I would have loved to have gone on and certainly worked on four with Pete and, mm-hmm. And Doug. But it wasn't to be. Yeah. It wasn't to be. I had to go to Romania and Bulgaria instead. But yeah, you know, everything changes.
Carol Sue Baker gets amazing credit.
Well, again, as I said,
did she have a good agent?
I think Tony. I think Tony likes music, and I think it's all to do with music. Yeah. And so, yeah, at the end of the day, and yeah, you see, there's some, you know, weird music things you hear. And
Christopher Young gets a good credit there. Yeah.
Well, I think Christopher Young should be credited on the front, personally. Yeah. The amount of his music's used in this one.
I assume by now you could no longer afford Christopher Young, who had begged for the job on Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd lobbied for it.
He actually lobbied for the job.
And then a couple of years later, he's on big films.
Maybe on everything. Yeah. You remember that time when everything had a Christopher Young music?
Yeah. I mean, he is still working and he is still great. I mean, I think he's never quite broken through to the sort of Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams level of music scoring.
I think if you went back and looked at his music now and put it all together in one thing, you'd go, oh, actually, yeah. I mean, and I still think the Hellraiser theme is fabulous.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're stuck with Motorhead on this one, with Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, I like Motorhead. You know, I prefer Leslie Gore.
Yeah, well, the problem with this one, of course, it is just Hellraiser repeated over and over and over again. It's not like it took a lot of work to do that.
Actually, even I think Town Without Pity at the end of Sundown works better.
I'm sure there could have been a nice old song on here, and I'm sure Anthony Hickox would have loved to have done that, as he's done before.
Probably like Screaming Jay Hawkins. is what I put a spell on you. Or,
but there we are. So there we are. Hellraiser 3. It's been fun. Oh wait, you know what I should do now? I should tell you that story I'm not allowed to tell you.